Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
SunburyMotors.com is the way to go to buy a car. You can go online to SunburyMotors.com, check out their incredible lines: Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, Kia. They're great pre-owned inventory. And not only that, you can check it out and you can get the buying process done from the comfort of your own home. Pretty good. That's SunburyMotors.com. And then, yeah, then eventually the dealerships are going to be open. And when you do, it's Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. All right. Play-by-play call of the day.
First round pick in 2002, having a monster night. And that pass is caught by David Martin, and he gets into the act with a touchdown. Third down and nine. Farr picks up another first down. An unbelievable night. And take a look at that. The rating is the highest of his career. This night will be remembered for Brett Favre. Period.
That was in Oakland when his dad passed away. And he threw four touchdown passes that night. Now, he's in the news right now for other reasons. kind of taking a chapter out of the Suits playbook. And was, what do you mean you didn't do that? All right, no. Just kidding, Suit, who, by the way, is all excited today. I mean, he's like a kid in a candy store. I have 12 emails from him on IndyCar restarting. I didn't even know half these locations had tracks. All right. Okay, so let's return to the head football coach of the Nittany Lions, James Franklin, and his teleconference that took place yesterday afternoon.
Hi. Hey, James, how you doing?
Good, Audrey. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm just wondering, we've kind of seen throughout the country the financial ramifications of this are going to continue to unfold in the coming months, maybe years. Do you have any concerns financially about the program? And also, has Sandy or has anyone talked about potentially taking a pay cut or anything like that?
Yeah, so yeah, I think there's always a concern about financial implications. I think, I'll be honest with you, as the football coach at Penn State, you always carry a little bit of that weight on your shoulders, that pressure on your shoulders, because you know that the success of football will rise all boats in the athletic department, and obviously has an impact on the community and everything else like we talked about before. So yeah, I think everybody is aware of that and everybody is sensitive to that. There's no doubt about it. You know, when it comes to, you know, changes that the athletic department, you know, will be making, I think everything is on the table and everything is being discussed. I think we're a little bit different than maybe some of the programs nationally because our athletic department is self-sustaining, which is different than a lot of, you know, programs across the country. I can't speak for anybody else. I don't think that would be appropriate, but me and my wife are doing something in terms of a gift to the university that's going to impact the students from a scholarship standpoint. But right now the way we're doing it, it's on an individual basis. And again, you know, those other things, you know, I wouldn't get into, you know, those things. But right now, you know, everything's on the table. Everything is being discussed. Obviously, the longer this goes, the conversation changes daily. You know, but right now, you know, there are personal decisions that are being made, and me and my wife have made that decision.
Dave Jones, Penn Live.
James, how are you?
Hey, Dave, how are you, man?
Well, I got to tell you, full disclosure, I'm a college T-shirt freak. And 10 minutes ago, I realized I had this on. And I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Just, you know, it's a
I wouldn't have noticed that if you didn't say it. Now, Audrey,
I know, but I can't tell a lie. You know, I was too late to change, and I was like, why change? Come on. I've been telling, we're all kind of flying blind on this thing, and I've been telling people who ask me, because everyone wants to know, and I don't know any more than anyone else, but I've been telling them that college football could very well be a lot more complicated to get up and running than the NFL, mainly because of two factors. The volume of testing that universities must perform on all their, you know, hundreds of student athletes, not just football players, and the ability of universities with amateurs compared with the pro franchises to get around liability, because, you know, the pros have collective bargaining units and colleges have a bunch of allegedly amateur athletes. So that seems like a sticky point to me. Do you agree that that's accurate or not?
Well, I think, first of all, they're two completely separate entities. And I think we can learn lessons from what professional sports are doing, but they're two completely different models. I think testing is going to be critical. Pre-testing and discussions before people come back. You know, we're fortunate because we're in what I would characterize as one of the safer communities when it comes to this. So our student athletes coming back to a place like this, where if you would happen to be in one of these cities or your university was around one of these cities that's considered a hotspot, that's even more challenging. But it's not like it reduces the impact, because we're still bringing students from challenging areas to our community. So there's got to be a lot of discussions and as much of, you know, I would describe it as pre-testing as we possibly can in terms of conversations. Where have you been? Where have you traveled? Any illness? Any people you've been around that have been, you know, affected? And then once we all get back on campus, you know, being able to do the testing like you're saying, and then be able to continue doing the testing, you know, throughout the season and throughout the semester. So you're exactly right. I do agree with you on that part. The other part, I just think they're two completely different models. But the other thing, you know, that I think is going to have to come in here is you just have to understand, I think there's going to be 90% of our team, when we say, hey, it's cleared and you're able to come back, they are going to run back. I mean, literally, we're having conversations with a lot of our guys that they can't come back. They're wanting to come back, because you have to understand, a lot of these guys have gone back to very different situations at home. Some of these guys, you know, their families have had other children and they don't have a bedroom anymore, or sleeping on the couch, or, you know, like you mentioned, there's five people on Wi-Fi in the house and they don't really have a place where they can study, you know, effectively, or a number. I mean, as you can imagine, we have players from all different backgrounds. So that factors into it. But there's also going to be 10%, maybe a little higher, maybe a little bit lower, that aren't comfortable coming back, or their families aren't comfortable with them coming back. And that's fine. You know, if you're not comfortable coming back and you want to stay at home, then we're supportive, because, again, at the end of the day, it's about what's in the student athlete's best interest and what are they comfortable with and what are their families comfortable with. So it's just a very different situation, but it is challenging. It is very challenging. And that's why there's so many different models out there that are being looked at. And what we all have to understand, too, is the model that may work for Penn State may be very different than what works at Arizona, or what works at Florida, or that works at Rutgers. They may be very different models based on our state, government decisions, and also what universities decide. So it's very complex, Dave. I agree with you from that standpoint.
Mike Gross, Lancaster Newspapers.
Hi, James. How are you?
Good, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for saying you believe in science. I wish everybody did. my question is about
science can be proven, right?
Yes, that's my understanding. Thank you. God bless you. As far as the part of returning, college football returning, that you can control, obviously most of it, a lot of it you can't control, but I heard Nick Saban say the other day that he always thought when his players came off winter conditioning, that was when they were in the best shape of the whole year, like going into spring ball. So he thought that if they could get like a month of condition of that sort of conditioning, like winter conditioning, then you could start preseason camp and have a normal length preseason camp and then play a season, wherever that piece, you know, 7-8 weeks or whatever it is, wherever that falls on the calendar. Does that sound reasonable to you? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think the model that most people are talking about is a 6-week model that would be ideal. But I think your point is a good one, and it's been discussed all over the country. People forget, very quickly we forget, that when I played college football, and a lot of people play college football, you weren't there all summer. You were home, you know, working out on your own, and you'd show up and you'd be in training camp for 3 weeks or a month before the season started, and you went and played. So yeah, I think you definitely can do it under 6 weeks. I think, you know, you could do it. I think you could do it in a month, because that's how it was always kind of run before. So I think, yeah, I think there's ways of getting it done. And I do think, based on a lot of the things we've already discussed, that we have to have some overarching guidelines that are important, that, again, are based on science and are based on the health and welfare of our student athletes. But we can make a lot of different models work, but we have to be flexible and we have to be willing and we have to be open to doing that. And fortunately, we got a bunch of really smart people that are working on this. And there's been a bunch of different models put together. But I think at the end of the day, we're going to have to be able to adjust and be flexible. Because the other thing that's not being discussed a whole lot is it's not like when we get back, things are going to be back to normal. I mean, you know, even just everybody coming back and getting physicals. In the old days, you'd have 120 people in the training room and you'd go from one circuit to the next, seeing the different doctors and getting all your tests done. And that's not going to happen. Those physical tests, when they arrive back on campus, may take 4 days because you're going to have to do them in small groups. You know, so there's a lot of things that have to be discussed. There's a lot of things that have to be decided. But I do think just the transition from them being at home to on campus and getting back to a point where you're able to meet and practice, it's going to take a lot more time than it normally does based on all the testing and procedures that are going to have to be followed.
Dennis Dodd, CBS Sports.
James, hi. Thanks for doing this. And clearly, Dave Jones' choice of wardrobe was antagonistic.
You can say that. You can say that. I can't say that. Dennis, you should come every week. Come every week.
I will. Two unrelated questions. I'm just going to ask one real quick and a follow-up. On the recruiting thing, are we now talking about virtual recruits, like guys you don't even meet, now committing, and is that to come? If not,
yeah, I think it is happening. There are kids that are committing to schools and they've never had visited. I think that is definitely happening. I think most of them, they have had interactions. So whether you were out January and December the previous year, at the end of the season, the previous spring, a lot of those type of prospects that are getting offered, someone on your staff has seen them before, type of deal. But I think your point is a good one, that you know, you do have players that are committing to schools and they haven't been there before. I don't think there's a lot of that, but there is some of that. There's no doubt about it. You know, obviously, again, it's not ideal, but I would say this, Dennis. We are in a situation now where there's more available information and resources and things through the internet and through computers and through Zoom meetings and tours and that you're able to get done, that you're able to get a lot of information. You know, it's interesting. I always tell young men that are going through this process, you know, they really should have done most of the homework like they're doing now before they visited these campuses anyway. You know, it's amazing how many kids will show up to our campus and they haven't done their homework ahead of time. When you ask a school what their graduation rate is, you should know the answer already, you know? So these are things that we try to talk to them about as much as we can, because I think that's my job as an educator, you know, to have these discussions about how to handle, you know, this process. But yeah, I do think that's happening, and I think you're probably going to see a little bit more of it. You're muted, Dennis. Chris?
Unmute me. Okay. Yeah, and then real quick, a follow-up, different subject. I know they've pushed the transfer waiver thing back. I just wanted to get your take on that. Nick Saban said right in the beginning when all this started, am I going to have to, you know, coach players differently, treat them differently because of this, because of the one-time transfer thing? I just wanted your take on it.
Well, I think a couple things. I think one of the big reasons why it was pushed back is there's no system of relief for the universities right now. If you did it without that other component, you know, I'm talking an extreme situation here, but what if you had University X and 30 players decided to transfer out right before the season and you had no way to recover those? That would be challenging. The other thing that's interesting, Dennis, is you push this back. Now you're going to have two major legislative changes in the same cycle. So you're going to have the NIL as well as the one-time transfer all hitting, you know, maybe the books at the same time. So that's going to be interesting. But I think that's the biggest reason, Dennis, is I think at this point everybody understands that these things are probably happening. But it's hard to kind of just put something in place without looking at it holistically and having some answers to maybe some of the challenges that come with it.
Donnie Collins, Grand Times Tribune.
Hey, James, how you doing?
Good, Donnie. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's May 6th, and in a given year when you would have had a normal spring practice, I'm assuming there's questions that would have been answered and things that you would have accomplished during the spring that you wanted to see. Without the spring practice, how challenging has it been to kind of gauge that? And are there ways where you think maybe given everything that's gone on and being able to do what you've been able to do that you might be a little ahead of where you thought you might have been?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously the obvious challenges that jump out is hiring a new offensive coordinator and not getting the normal spring practice to be able to install, watch it, refine it, you know, and make adjustments. And then the same thing by position coaches, you know, obviously Coach Scott with the D-line, being able to work with those guys and know what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. But I do think we've been able to get a lot more meeting time than you normally would get. Because a lot of times, you know, during spring ball, it's a sprint. Like, you go into that meeting and you're sprinting to discuss, you know, what you need to get installed for that practice, and then you go out and try to execute it. And it's like that. It's like a constant sprint, where this is, okay, let's talk through things in detail. Let's have a discussion. You know, let's have a conversation back and forth. Let's take quizzes and tests and things like that. So I do think from a strictly learning perspective, I think this has been really good. But the problem is there's the physical aspects of this that we're not getting, the muscle memory, the fundamentals, techniques. The interesting thing is I kind of go back and forth a little bit. As football coaches, we're a little bit of the paranoid population. And it's like the playbook, you know, if the playbook gets out there and someone gets our playbook, well, if you don't understand all the nuances of the playbook and how the plays actually work and all the little coaching points that make it really successful on offense, defense, or special teams, that's what allows you to be good. That's what allows you to really make things go. And that's the challenge. I think the teaching is excellent, but as we all know, we have so many different types of learners. There's guys that can learn
on a computer screen. There's guys that need to learn by taking notes and getting up on a board and drawing the play or having a discussion. And there's some guys that need the actual reps, the physical reps to learn. So typically as coaches, we try to teach using all of these different available teaching methods. And right now we're limited to not having all this. So some of our learners aren't getting what they need.
That is head football coach James Franklin. And he's right. That's something I've talked about many times. There are different ways that people learn. Sometimes you can draw it up, they know right away. Other people, you can talk them through it, they got it. Other people, you physically have to show them. It's just different ways. Sometimes you need to do it with a video. It's different ways of learning. And right now, for those who need to be, who actually have to go through it and be shown it, in other words, you know, you sit there and you've got to take them through it out on a practice field, can't do that right now. Sometimes on Zoom, you can say, okay, like, show me what you're doing here. Yeah, you can do that, but that is, one of the challenges. All right, we will come back with more in a moment. Great to have you with us. Scott Lauber, next half hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. By the way, the service department at Sunbury Motors open Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m., and don't forget that you can go online now to buy cars. SunburyMotors.com. Ford, Lincoln, Kia, Hyundai, great pre-owned inventory. You can shop online, find what you like, and guess what? You can do all this from the comfort of your own home at SunburyMotors.com. Very pleased to be joined by Scott Lauber from the Philadelphia Inquirer, who has written really a fun book that I think every Philly fan will love, The Big 50. Scott, welcome to the show. We really hope you and yours are very safe during this time.
Hi, Steve. Same to you. Hopefully everyone's safe and healthy up there.
They are. Thank you for asking. So let's start with The Big 50. Now, these are books that are written about various franchises, and you were selected to write this one. What was tougher, 45 through 50 or figuring out 1 through 5?
Definitely 45 through 50. And,
yep.
I'll say that, that was really part one of the project, was kind of putting the list together. And, it's a collection of stories about players, coaches, managers, people, and then also years and moments that have defined the Phillies over the course of their history, which dates back to 1883. So for me, 1 and 2 were really easy. The team has won 2 World Series, so you've got to start with 1980 and 2008. And then I started to think about who were the greatest players in franchise history, and Mike Schmidt, Steve Carlton, and Robin Roberts, and Richie Ashburn, and those Hall of Famers sort of come to mind. So it was helpful to me to kind of think of this especially with regard to the players in terms of tiers. Like, Schmidt and Carlton are in the first tier with Roberts, and what that is. And then
sure.
Like, right behind them are your close two Hall of Famers, like, somebody like a Chase Utley, somebody like a Jimmy Rollins, guys who might make it, might not make it. They'll be kind of on the borderline when their time comes, but you know their role in franchise history. And the longer you go down the list, you say to yourself, well, how am I going to get this guy in, or how am I going to fit that game in?
Yeah.
And I cheated in certain areas. I combined some things, and it's called The Big 50, but it's more like 55 ultimately. But then, you do have, things that get left on the cutting room floor. Like, I really wanted to find a place in this book for Scott Rolen. He's someone I vote for the Hall of Fame every year,
right.
And I just couldn't find it. So definitely 45 through 50, because I probably could have gone deeper than that.
what's interesting is that obviously Steve Carlton has to be in here somewhere, and you've got him at number four. And you ended up talking to the two catchers that caught him more than anybody, Tim McCarver, Bob Boone, I think. But they gave completely different stories about him, which gave, I think, a better, well-rounded picture of the man. Would that be fair?
Yeah. I mean, look, what I tried to do with as many of the chapters as I could was to tell a story from either a different perspective or a story I hadn't heard before. Because, look, let's face it, you know, I'm writing about people and moments that everyone has written about and read about for many, many years. It's going to be very difficult, I think, to break new ground on a lot of these topics. Mike Schmidt has written his own book, you know, and so it's like you're probably not going to uncover a whole lot that's brand new about these people. But, you know, you might find perspectives that you hadn't heard before, or you might find stories that you hadn't heard before. And that's what I tried to do wherever I could. And with Carlton, I mean, we probably could have had a conversation and sat and talked for a half hour and could have rehashed his career. It was never going to be the definitive Steve Carlton story. That's been told. So what I tried to do with that chapter was, you know, in sort of talking to Bob Boone about some other things, we started talking about Steve Carlton. And he told me about what a difficult time he had right in the beginning when the two of them were teammates beginning in 72. What a difficult time he had to kind of earn Carlton's trust and become Carlton's guy. And, you know, there were times during Carlton's tenure with the Phillies where they brought in other catchers that Carlton, quite frankly, was more comfortable with, one of them being Tim McCarver, who caught him in St. Louis. And when I talked to Tim McCarver, he gave me a completely different sort of story about his experience catching Carlton, and yet there were elements in there of what he had to do and what he did to gain Carlton's trust. He was, let's not forget, he was more of a veteran catcher when Carlton was a young pitcher in St. Louis. And, you know, they had some situations where Carlton wanted to do something and McCarver basically, you know, got him to trust him to do it their way, to do it a different way. And Carlton kind of gained that trust over time. So by the end of it, of course, by the late 70s and early 80s, Boone and Carlton were very much in sync, but it took a while to get there. And I thought that was an interesting way of telling the Steve Carlton story.
Yeah, because I think people forget that Steve Carlton was actually in the starting rotation for the Cardinals when they were in the 67 World Series, and McCarver was the catcher. I mean, people forget that part sometimes. Pete Rose in 1980. Look, all the success with the Reds, winning in 75, winning in 76. But the Phillies' experience, especially after 97 years, for goodness sake, Scott. I mean, you're talking about the team that has more losses than anybody. It hit him in a different way than it did with the Reds, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, you talk to a lot of the players from that group. They give Pete a lot of credit for kind of being, in a lot of ways, the missing piece. You know, the large majority of that team was homegrown. They came up together. They were around the same age. I'm talking about the Schmidts and the Boas and the Lozinskis and the Boones. And, you know, they were very much at a similar stage in each of their own careers, you know. And while they were all close in their own way, you know, it sort of took bringing in somebody like Pete Rose, who was a little older, who had championship rings from his years with the Big Red Machine, to kind of come in and, for lack of a better way to put it, sort of show them the way. And, you know, in talking with Pete, you know, it was really interesting how he viewed the Phillies from the other side of the field in the late 70s. And he said, you know, there were times where he told Joe Morgan, there's nothing wrong with this Phillies team except that, you know, they don't have me, and or they don't have, you know, a guy like me or a guy like Morgan who had been through it, had won, had known what it was like to get over the top. And when he had an opportunity to go over as a free agent, you know, he had other offers. He had offers from Kansas City and Pittsburgh and Atlanta and some other teams. you know, one of the appeals to him about coming here was that he wanted to sort of be able to join that group that he thought so highly of. And I think that there were some guys who weren't aware of how they were regarded around the league. You know, Pete came in and he told Mike Schmidt, you know, for my money, you're the best third baseman in baseball. And the way Pete read it was Schmidt didn't necessarily believe that himself until he heard Pete Rose say it. So, right. You know, Pete came in and brought sort of a different perspective and a different experience from his own career, and in a lot of ways was helpful in terms of showing that team the way and showing them how to win and finally getting over the hump.
Yeah. I want to steal a quote from the book. As prolific author and devout Phillies fan James A. Michener wrote in the New York Times in 1978, it is traditional to say I supported them in good years and bad. There were no good years. I cheered in bad and worse. Which, because you write a paragraph here which sums up 97 years of bad. I mean, just bad along the way. That's why today, I wonder if... Do fans today understand how good they have it now compared to how the fans had it for so many years before 1980?
I know. I mean, for a generation of fans, and I'm 43, so I don't appreciate it the way older people might who lived through a large portion of that. I mean, you know, it's funny when you're doing something like this, a project like this, you start to think about what you're writing about, and you realize you're really focusing. The large majority of Philly's history takes place in two very, very short eras of time. The late 70s and early 80s was the golden era, part one, and yep. 2006 or 7 to 2011 is the golden era, part two. And other than that, you've got some what I call pop-up seasons, like 1950, the Whiz Kids, and 64, which is remembered for the wrong reasons because they collapsed down the stretch, and 1993, and you have a few of those pop-up seasons, but there is a vast wasteland of time in the 40s and for most of the 50s and 60s that they were just not only a bad team but a last place team. And so it is really amazing when you sort of go through their history and you think about all the things the franchise went through. It's why, you know, I wrote a chapter about the 1980 NLCS, which was an epic series against the Astros, and I think you could make a case that Game 5, which was the deciding game in that series, where they come back late and beat Nolan Ryan, they come back against Nolan Ryan, then lose the lead and have to win it in the 10th. That series and that game specifically is the most important game in Philly's history, because if they don't win it and they don't move on to the World Series, I think there's a good chance. I mean, Bob Boone and Larry Boa were telling me there was not a good chance. It was almost a certainty that part of that group was going to be broken up the following right. year if they didn't finally win it in 1980. And now, if you think about it and you remove the 1980 World Series, what are the Phillies in the 80s and 90s? They are basically the Cubs and Red Sox, right? They're lovable losers who, unlike those teams, which just hadn't won in forever, the Phillies would have never won, period. So, I mean, you just think about their history up until the late 70s and early 80s and how much different it would be now had that not happened. It's pretty remarkable that the franchise is defined by kind of that one period of time.
In my sports broadcasting class at Penn State, I will start in the initial class once I give them the syllabus. You know, giving your name, where you're from, what's your favorite team, who's your favorite broadcaster. And inevitably, I have a section of the class that is from southeastern Pennsylvania or from southern New Jersey. And even to this day, Scott, when I ask about favorite broadcaster, many times in a class, I'll hear the name Harry Callis. Now, Harry's been dead 11 years. You know, and these kids are about 21 right now. You know, they're 21. It's a 400-level class, so they're 21, 22 years old. And I know in my football broadcast partner, Jack Kim, had the privilege of working with Harry on NFL games. Loved him. How did you want to approach that chapter?
Yeah, it's a great point. So Harry's in the top 10 for me, and that's saying a lot because he never played a game. You know, he never put the uniform on. And he's the first non-uniformed to come up in the book. You know, like later on, I write about some general managers and some owners and some team presidents and whatnot. But Harry's in the top 10, and you know, I began covering the Phillies in 2006 for the Wilmington News Journal, so I got to know him a little bit late in his life, and it was easy for me to see. I mean, growing up in New Jersey and then being around him a little bit, it was easy for me to understand at that point the relationship he had built with the region. I'm impressed, really, that you've got, you know, students in your class that still cite Harry, because as you said, you know, they were for half their lives he's been gone.
Yes.
And you know, it's amazing. So what I did with that chapter was I talked to his son Todd, who he's now a broadcaster with the Houston Astros. And back in 2008, when the Phillies were in the World Series, Todd Callis worked on the Tampa Bay Rays broadcast, and he and Harry had an opportunity to call an inning together in the World Series, which I thought was the epitome of cool at the time. And you know, as time has gone on, I've just thought about it, and I think it's cooler and cooler that they were able to have that moment together, both as fellow broadcasters and of course as father and son. And we talked a lot about that, and I had him sort of take me through what it was like to call an inning with his dad, who's a Hall of Fame broadcaster. So you know, it was really awesome conversation to have with him, and we talked a little bit about growing up as Harry Callis's son. And he said, you know, he'd go to school and, you know, his friends would find out, you know, that he was Harry Callis's son, and he'd get the usual questions, you know, do you know Mike Schmidt, do you know Steve Carlton, you know, do you know these guys? But then he said, you know, his friends would really get excited on the days that Harry would come pick him up from school, because Harry was the one they really wanted to see and to talk to, and he was more popular than a lot of the players. And he himself is very touched by the fact that all these years later, you know, after Phillies wins at Citizens Bank Park, they still play the High Hopes, the video of Harry singing High Hopes. And I told him I think that could go on forever, and he said, well, I hope so, but eventually people aren't going to know the significance of that or what it means or who that is. And I said, I think you're underestimating that. I think that, you know, people will continue to tell their kids who Harry Callis was, the same way they tell them who Robin Roberts was, and ultimately they'll tell them who Mike Schmidt was. I think he's that much of a figure in franchise history. So I think the fact that your students know who Harry Callis is and cite him as one of their favorites speaks to the fact that that legacy is living on.
I told, when we had Todd on the show, I think a year and a half ago, we had Todd on the show, and I told him that story. He was incredibly touched by that, and you could tell it meant a lot to him. The book, by the way, is The Big 50, Philadelphia Phillies. Scott Lauber, forward, by the way, by Larry Anderson. It is a must for any Phillies fan. The men and moments that made the Philadelphia Phillies. I just want to ask one quick side question out of that. Your thoughts on status of the season?
Yeah, it's really this month is really going to be very interesting.
Agreed.
You know, the people that I talk to within the game, you know, the first thing that they say is that they're optimistic and they're hopeful. And I think that the optimism stems from the fact that everybody wants to have some kind of a season. You know, at a time when owners, MLB owners and players don't agree on a whole hell of a lot, they do agree on the fact that they want to play this year. Some season is better than no season. But, you know, ultimately it's, and that's, I think, why you hear about, you know, all these different concepts that MLB is coming up with for how they can do this. You know, whether it's the Arizona plan or the Arizona-Florida plan or playing in everyone's home stadiums. And I think that they've used these 7 weeks to come up with a lot of ideas, and now they'll get to a point, or they're getting to a point, where they're going to have to begin to pitch some of the more realistic ideas to the players, get their input on it, get their thoughts on it. And even after that's done, and even after they negotiate with the players on what compensation would be like, because that's going to become an issue, although I don't think it's going to be a huge issue. I think they'll resolve it. There are going to be parts of this that are out of MLB's hands. You know, how widespread does testing become, you know, to the point where teams can have access to the testing they need to put on games? You know, and where does the virus go from here? So They're optimistic because they have a desire to do it, but ultimately I think the virus is going to dictate what happens here. And so even while you're hearing about these plans and the fact that MLB is finally going to begin to talk to the players specifically about different, you know, to get specific about different plans with the players next week, and that's all good, that's all progress. Some things need to happen in order for this to move forward, and I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Scott, an absolute pleasure. Best of luck with the book. I think any Phillies fan is going to gobble it up anyway because it's fabulous, and appreciate your time and your work very much.
Thanks so much for having me. Anytime.
Scott Lauber with the Philadelphia Inquirer. We talked about the book. It's a must for any Phillies fan. In fact, right now, as we speak, Matt's ordering it. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by SunburyMotors.com. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. And our thanks to Scott Lauber. We were just talking about Chip Kelly during the break. And I didn't realize Matt's a huge Chip Kelly fan.
Oh, jeez. Let's just skip this right now.
I don't get it, Matt.
This, luckily, all I could do is just laugh at him now that the Eagles have won a Super Bowl and the next hiring after him. Biggest fraudulent head coach in football history.
See, it's important for me before the end of the show that I get this out of you. I don't want you to look at little Luke and, like, yell at him like that. You can yell at me all you want. I just get concerned. I have to be the pseudo-uncle. So you're saying that you don't want UCLA to succeed?
Yeah.